I had wanted to be a Marine since a quite young age. The way they carried themselves, the way that they wore their kit. In particular, this organization called Royal Marines. Green berets and their camouflage cream, and it all just seemed really exotic, really cool. If I can be someone like that, then that feels like, it feels like progress. So I joined 98. I remember flying in there in pitch darkness, you know, the back of a Chinook helicopter with just a red light on so you can vaguely see the insides of the cockpit. And we've been circling around in the Arabian Gulf just waiting for the green light. The green light came. Here we go, fellas. We're in 8,000 miles or whatever from home. As we progressed, effectively beyond the point of no return and feasible escape routes, the temperature just plummeted. The cold weather injuries that start presenting themselves felt like arthritis starting to develop in my body. My joints would stiffen up and become painful. I could feel my creativity diminishing, my motivation diminishing. I think I would be lying, and most people would be. But at the same time, it's frightening as well, for the very obvious reasons that you...
Tommy, there was a specific night of horror which you and your fellow ex-Marine Steve Howarth talked about, which occurred on a Norwegian mountain plateau about an hour north of Tromsø, within the Arctic Circle. What do you remember about that?
A night of horror that could probably apply to most nights in Arctic Norway during the winter. The Marines, as you might know, every year will deploy up to Arctic Norway for a number of months over the winter. And this is all in the name of developing and maintaining an expertise in mountain and cold weather warfare. What better place to do it than Arctic Norway? And the nature of your time out there is taking people who've never been to Norway ever before and developing their abilities, their skills, their ability to survive, to operate in such hostile environments. And this is done through, you know, an incremental process where the pressure builds up over time, the conditions that you're exposed to, the terrain that you find yourself operating in, the daylight hours, of which there aren't many, just ratchet up as you go along. And on this particular night, we were probably about 2.5-3 months into this particular deployment, and this would have been 2005, I think. You know, we had, Steve was the commander of Zula Company, an outfit within 4-5 Commando, approximately 100, 120 men. I was a commander of 4-5's recce troop, approximately 30 odd men. We were co-located together, and we had free rein, really, as a body to decide where within the terrain and where within the environment we wanted to conduct this particular exercise that we were part of. And Steve and I, we both thought, let's go as high as possible. Let's get right up above the tree line, up onto the top of the mountain plateau, you know, the full force of the elements, and let's just bring everything together. So that's what we did. And over the course of 3 or 4 days, you know, we played soldiers up in the mountains. And on the final night, which was the final night of this particular exercise, there was a nighttime ski march that we had programmed in across a particular mountain plateau. And it was 20, 30 kilometers, something like that. And as we were setting off, I remember just feeling the sensation on, you know, my nose, the way that the breath, or rather the way that the air feels as you breathe in. You can tell that the temperature has dropped really, really suddenly. The wind picked up. We did a thermometer check before setting off just to confirm that this was within the bounds of safety and all the rest of it. And it just was. So we decided to go for it. And, you know, we launched ourselves, me, Steve, and, you know, 150 blokes, up into the mountains, across the plateau, heading from A to B. And as we progressed, effectively beyond the point of no return and beyond what could have been feasible escape routes, the temperature just plummeted. The wind picked up. The the temperature probably would have been somewhere in the region of minus 25, minus 30, something like that. Mm. Which is workable with the correct kit. But if yep. you add wind to that, wind chill. The wind just exacerbates the cold and just makes it so much colder and so much harder to operate. And it's the middle of the night, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, you can't see anything at all. The wind's howling, it's absolutely freezing. And Steve and I, we've both been out to Norway quite a few times before, as had the vast bulk of the guys who were up there with us. But of course, some of the younger lads who never had been before, this was their first time. Mm. And over the course of what became the night from hell, just the cold weather injuries that start presenting themselves up on top of the mountains, which we had no ability to do anything about other than just keep on going, wow. just started to present. And it was ultimately a situation that we stayed in control of and brought it to a safe conclusion. But it was a night not without a degree of concern, just because of how isolated and exposed we were in the elements, away from help or rescue should we have actually needed it.
And you're talking like frostbite and things like that.
Yeah, those sorts of things. Mm. The telltale signs of that is, guys stopping feeling sensations in their toes, in their fingers, the tips of noses starting to stop playing. And all we could do was keep going. Which is what we did, but it very much felt like a being past the point of no return, fully committed, with the responsibility, of course, of everybody that was with us.
And you got full kit on.
Oh yeah, full kit on. So big skis, big rucksacks, and when I say big, I mean big. Big things, because of all of the kit that you end up carrying in environments like that, the weight really, really adds up. 100, 120 pounds is not uncommon.
Okay.
There you are in darkness, with this maelstrom blowing around you, just on a compass bearing. This was pre-smartphone and...
Yeah.
Got an app for that type days. This was just a compass bearing with a vague luminous point at the tip of it, and just having faith that your map reading was on point, and just going and not stopping.
And that's all you could do, was keep going ultimately.
Yeah.
And what was the result of keeping going? What was the fallout from that?
Well, the result of keeping going was that we... definitely made the right decision. Had we attempted to turn around or to find an unproven escape route or to just stop and freeze, literally, whilst working out what to do next, then, of course, cold weather injuries would have been a lot, lot worse. I think in the end we had 7 cases of frostbite, which isn't insubstantial. And, it's a really serious thing.
Yeah.
The minute that somebody succumbs to frostbite, then from an operational perspective, as a Marine, as a soldier, they become non-effective.
Yeah.
And the nature of cold weather injuries is that once you succumb to them, then for the rest of your life, you've then got a susceptibility to them. So, if you get frostbite in your toes 1 year, the chances are if you redeploy back to, in our case, Norway the following year, then you're going to have trouble with the same toes.
Really? Okay, so, I didn't know that. Right.
So, the lengths that are gone to prevent and avoid these things, are absolutely massive. Mm. And, the fallout for Steve and I, and particularly Steve, because he was a senior commander, put him in quite an uncomfortable position. His integrity, his professional judgment were being called into question. And, Steve is an incredibly professional, competent, experienced guy. And as I said earlier, the decisions that we made were the right decisions. We just found ourselves in a particularly unpleasant set of conditions that we couldn't have predicted, yeah. And we made the best of it. Mm. But yeah, there was a bit of fallout at the end of it.
And afterwards. Steve is your now business partner at Jotnar.
Yes, yeah. So Steve and I have known each other for, I suppose, 20 odd years. You know, Steve is several years older than I am. You know, we were never close pals whilst in the Marines, but professionally we'd worked with each other a number of times.
Okay.
And whilst I ended up leaving the Marines a couple of years before Steve, we stayed in touch. And, you know, I think I was probably Steve's canary in the coal mine as far as becoming a civilian was concerned. And we'd carried on talking during that period. And it became clear that for both of us independently, and then we both discovered collectively, just has this real urge to not follow, I suppose, a well-worn path that many former Marine officers do.
Yeah.
And, you know, jump on the 608 to Paddington. Mm. We didn't want that. We wanted something else. We wanted to build something. So the idea and the knowledge that a business at some point lay in our future just started to trickle through during that two-year gap, mm-hmm. after I'd left and before he ended up leaving.
And years later, you were climbing in Chamonix, and you get a phone call,
yeah.
from Steve.
Yeah,
tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I'd left the Marines now. I joined in 98. I left in 2008. This would have been the summer of 2010. Summer 2010. And again, we'd been having these conversations between the two of us, just developing ideas about, for him, when he came to leave the Marines, which was now becoming imminent, and me with this growing sense that I wanted to build something. Mm. And I was in the south of France, just outside Chamonix. Been out there for 7 or 8 weeks. Me and my wife in our camper van, we'd just been cruising around, climbing, and just living like vagrants in our van, which is one of our favorite things to do.
Sounds idyllic, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. And there was a call from Steve, and he said, "Hiya, what are you up to?" And I said, "Oh, I'm just coiling a rope and throwing it in the back of the van. I'm down in Chamonix. What about you?" He said, I'm up at the range in Cardiff choosing a particular color of lino for my new kitchen. I think you've got the better life at the moment." So, you know, we just chewed the fat, and, you know, within the course of about a half hour conversation, we'd agreed that when I got back, which was another couple of weeks in the future, we would meet up in Cwmcarn in the south of Wales, you know, mountain bike trail centre. We're both really into mountain biking as well. And we'd go and ride our bikes around and have a chat about what this urge towards a business in the future might look like.
Interesting. And we'll definitely come back to that. But tell me about your time in the forces. Is it a time after like a decade or more in business you now look back on fondly?
Mm, yeah, very much. I had wanted to be a Marine since, you know, really quite young age.
How young were you talking,
Tommy? 12, 13.
Oh, wow, okay.
That yeah, sort really of young. Age. But as an adult, just the greatest gift I think you could ever give a child as a parent is the freedom to go out there into the world and to be encouraged to learn your way, to learn from your mistakes, to find your own path, for them to not jump in the way and haul us out of danger's way, or to try and step in and protect us from the danger that we were quite evidently walking into. And I think what that did for the three of us, because incidentally, we come from a completely non-military family, but
okay.
All three of us joined the forces.
Oh, really? Yeah, okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I can't remember exactly where it came from, but just this awareness of the military as a thing. And in particular, this organization called the Royal Marines had their green berets and their camouflage cream, and there was a mystique and an aura to them. And even back then, as a young boy, it all just seemed really exotic and really cool. And I remember thinking, if I can one day, when I grow up and become an adult, if I can be someone like that, then that feels like progress. It feels like progress. And I suppose as I got older and the more I learned and came to know about a potential career in the forces, I was seized by the opportunity, again, if I could ever be good enough and be selected to become an officer in the Marine. The Marines, you have a number of specializations that you can take if you wish. You become a weapons expert, a physical training instructor, but you can also become what's known within the Marines as a mountain leader. You know, this is an organization. It's approximately 80 people strong. Within the whole Marines, which, you know, is 5,500, 6,000 strong, something like that. You know, really.
And 80 people out of that.
Super
specialized.
Yeah, who are called the Mountain Leader Cadre, to give them their full name. And the individuals within it are known, you know, generically as MLs or Mountain Leaders.
Okay.
And the name is a misnomer. Yes, of course, a lot of stuff takes place within the mountains, but the function of the MLs is surveillance and reconnaissance, plus the development of a deep expertise in mountain and cold weather warfare. So those things make the MLs within the Marines, you know, effectively the tip of the spear from a deployment,
from
makes
a sense.
Soldiering perspective. You know, a very small group of incredibly highly trained specialist individuals who go through a 9-month selection and training course, which is renowned for its beastliness and its attrition rate, in order that they can then pop out the end of that and slot into these pretty consequential roles that enable you as a young NCO or a young officer, in my case, to make some pretty big decisions as far as the deployment of the wider follow-on commando forces might be. So, you know, it's a very well-respected, revered outfit within the Marines. The MLs as individuals, when I first joined, hugely looked up to these characters. The Marines as an organization, incredibly professional and well regarded anyway, but these guys were just a whole step up.
Right.
The way they looked, the way they carried themselves, the way that they wore their kit, ultra professionals. I mean, go as far as saying real craftsmen their trade.
Yeah.
All of them with a twinkle in their eye as well, you know, and I wanted that same twinkle in my eye, and I wanted also to be a real craftsman of my trade. And of course, by this stage, I developed an affinity for the outdoors and for the mountains from such an early age that this was almost an opportunity to just take that, turbocharge it, put it on steroids from a professional capacity. So it seemed the obvious thing to do.
And where does somebody in mountain troop then, where do you ultimately see like combat action? What kind of countries, terrain do you?
Yeah. So I joined, as I said, in 98. By the time I passed out of training, my whole generation, this was just before 9/11.
Prior
to that, any operational deployment, if you were lucky, be a Northern Ireland tour or maybe something in the Balkans. Whereas all of a sudden, from this phase onwards, boom, the world changed. And if you're in the right place at the right time, then my God, for the next 14, 15 years, just the operational indulgence you would have in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Kosovo as well was my first deployment immediately after training. And you in all of these environments that the Marines operate, the MLs, who are Marines also, they will operate also, but they will act as the reconnaissance troops. So the first boots on the ground, the first to land on a landing site to secure it, the first to prove a route through a mountain pass in order to allow follow-on troops to follow, the first off a boat onto the base of a cliff to climb up in darkness in order to fix lines for the follow-on forces to join. So, you know, wherever the Marines go, the MLs are there, and they're very much at the forefront. And it was when I was in Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan, prior to actually qualifying as an ML, that, you know, I looked at these guys in action and thought, yeah, I want some of that. So for me, it was 2003 at the end of the Iraq deployment that I'd just been on, which was the first... It was when the Iraq War began, so, you know, the
War on Terror and labeling got given, all of that.
Yeah. Okay. And the Commando Brigade
landed
and were the first conventional boots on the ground on the Alfour Peninsula. And I remember flying in there in pitch darkness, you know, in the back of a Chinook helicopter with just a red light on, so you could vaguely see the insides of the cockpit. And we'd been circling around in the Arabian Gulf, just waiting for the green light, and the green light came, and the loadie gave us thumbs up, and we're like, "Yeah, here we go, fellas, we're in." So, you know,
was it feel like that emotion?
Was it feel like, it's a mixture. I think I would be lying, and most people would be doing likewise in my position by saying that they weren't excited by the prospect of doing this, because ultimately, it's what I joined to do it for 100%. Real.
Yeah, you trained.
It really
to do
is. But at the same time, it's frightening as well for the very obvious reasons that you can think of. You know, there's a physical harm that you could very likely come to, and the intelligence threat assessment was that in our first wave of 6 or 8 Chinooks, I forget quite how many it was that were landing. On the very southern tip of the Alfour Peninsula, of that eight, we could expect for at least 2 of them to be shot down en route by air defence systems. So, of course, that focused the mind.
Yeah.
Am I going to be one of the 8? You know, the dice is effectively being rolled. And what can you do? What can you do? But just go with it. So we all went with it. And I remember landing on this marshy ground just outside the town of Alfour. You know, we ran off the tailgate. You know, we high-fived the US Navy SEALs who'd gone in a couple of hours before us just to secure the landing site. They jumped back on the helos. They then flew off. And there we were, 8,000 miles or whatever from home, in the middle of nowhere, with just red lights from aircraft everywhere. And just this incredible noise of combat, of gunfire, of, you know, human communication, just the whole machinery of war. It was quite something. And, you know, I was 26, 27, something like that. I was, you know, I was a captain by this stage. I was a forward air controller. So, you know, my job, you know, me and my small team, our job was to call in aircraft in support of ground troops, you know, basically to drop bombs in support of the guys on the ground. And up above me was, you know, Spectre gunships, F-18s, Harrier, Lynx gunships, all of them circling up above in radio contact with me. And it was my job to coordinate these outrageous weapons of war just flying up above, and to do it correctly in order to support the maneuver that was taking place on the ground. And again, I would have thought my younger self that at the age of 26, 27, you're pretty grown up. You know, I'm 48 now, and I know 27-year-olds who can hardly even dress themselves.
Yeah.
And it just shows. Yeah. I know it's a really long answer to your question. Just for those people who join the military, the opportunity it gives for just your development, your ability to take all of these incredible, unique situations that you find yourself in, you know, that all have the potential to unseat you, overwhelm you, to learn how to navigate your way through these whilst maintaining your head, whilst maintaining your ability to think, to make good decisions, and to do this with such regularity, you know, as was the case, you know, as I said, with my generation, just doing this for this 14-year period. Mm. You know, if that's your introduction to effectively working life, you know, it's my first job.
Yeah.
Then, yeah. You know, it's going to set you up, I would have thought, pretty well for what comes next, because, you know, stress, uncertainty, fear, you know, these are universal things, aren't they?
Yeah.
So if you can develop a mindset and an acclimatization with them, then so much the better, you know.
Mm. And did you, during that time or during your whole time there, escape like injury free, or unlike our friend Steve McCulley, who
I was one of the lucky ones. Many didn't. You know, of course, many didn't come back home.
No.
And
no,
many came back home, as you know, you've met, with, you know, life-changing injuries. I mean, genuinely life-changing injuries. So no, I didn't. I was one of the lucky ones. But, you know, what governs that?
Yeah.
Luck.
Yeah, yeah.
It is. It's something that you can, I think, allow yourself to become so disorientated by the uncontrollable nature of combat that you could very easily, if you're not attuned and adept at just maintaining a bit of poise, you could very quickly lose yourself to, because we're normally in control from day to day and from moment to moment, and you can predict what's going to happen tomorrow, and you can take measures to mitigate and whatever. But, you know, when you're in the middle of a gunfight at 2 o'clock in the morning and you don't know which way is up or down, you know, you're either in the path of a bullet or a grenade or whatever it might be, or you're not.
Yeah.
And I think it takes a particular type of acceptance to come to terms with the fact that you actually do not have control.
Yeah.
And it's a really powerful lesson, I think. You know, maybe talk more about it later, but just the way in which control and your relationship with it can have such a profound impact on the outcomes that come your way. I mean, what you can control is your response to the stimulus.
Okay.
That you can control.
Yeah.
And if you become practiced and adept at doing that in stressful situations, then when you find yourself, as Steve and I both did, in this alien world called business, nothing made sense. All the old rules were out the window. Nothing worked. You know, I reach back to those days and pull that ability to just sit with discomfort, allow the process to work its way through, and then take a decision.
And just interested to know, again, you know, that element of controlling the controllables and not being able to, you know, control what you can't. How much were you aware again of what's being talked about in the media and in hindsight now, so many years past, and people questioning why we were here, why we were there, and you're like 8,000 miles from home. Does that affect you, like looking in the rearview mirror now, or at the time you probably, you're in the moment, aren't you, ultimately? You're doing what you're trained to do, as you said.
Yes, it's a really great question. We were all youngsters, and we were all being given these opportunities to go and do fundamentally what we wanted to go and do, to prove ourselves as individuals and collectively, professionally amongst our peers, as being the professional, competent, capable operators that we hoped, thought that we were. And there's absolutely no doubt that I wanted these opportunities. I really wanted these opportunities. And, you know, I wasn't a bloodlusting war dog or anything like that, but it was an opportunity to go and do the job for real. So I wanted to go and do it. And I don't think anybody else around me felt differently. But I remember being aware in 2003, particularly in advance of the Iraq war, the groundswell of questioning and then outright resistance and protesting that was taking place about this increasingly imminent war that was about to happen. And I remember being frustrated by this because it was risking our opportunity to be able to go and do this thing that I felt at the time, knowing what very little I knew at the time politically.
Yeah.
And I was concerned that that chance, that opportunity might be squandered. I mean, how selfish and how inwardly thinking is that? But I remember there's quite a well-known example of an RAF officer who I don't think would have been that much older than me, but who refused to deploy to Iraq because, as far as he was concerned, this was an illegitimate and illegal war, and there was no grounds for it.
Wow.
So he refused. And I remember thinking, on the one hand, I can't believe that you feel this way about something that to me seems so clear cut.
Yeah.
But the other part of me was thinking, my God, I wish I had the awareness that you clearly have to lead you to this conviction that you so clearly have to make such a bold and courageous decision.
Yeah.
And I was really conflicted by that.
And can you feel other people questioning that at the same time when that kind of news gets out?
I don't remember it having a knock-on effect in the way that many had feared that might do.
Okay.
It was, as far as I'm aware, it was a pretty isolated case, but it's one that stuck with me just as an incredible example of moral courage and self-belief. Yeah. You know, hat off to the guy.
And interested to know, you said your other siblings went into the military as well. What did they end up doing out of interest?
So my younger brother, Paddy, he became a submariner.
Okay.
And he spent several 6 months tours underwater somewhere on a nuclear submarine as an engineer. And my sister Lorna, she's a banker by profession, but she joined the TA.
Okay.
And served with the Honourable Artillery Company in London, and she ended up doing a tour of Afghanistan. And she took 6 months out of her career as a banker and went off and lived in the desert.
Wow.
For 6 months. Yeah.
Wow. And how did that experience, you know, over a good decade, ultimately prepare you for starting, scaling, growing a business?
Yeah. So I think what it did was just continued on in a turbocharged kind of a way the path that I think I had been and my brother and sister, Lauren and Paddy, set on as kids. Get out there into the world, go and do hard things. Mm. And the Marines for me was 10 years of doing hard things and finding ways of becoming comfortable with those. it was also 10 years of, you know, really developing a sense of self-reliance, personal resilience, initiative. I don't know what you would call it. You know, I often think that, you know, the word entrepreneurialism is very loosely defined and has been widely hijacked. You know, I always see it as just being more of a spirit, you know, a sense of spirit, something about, you know, an indomitable nature, an ability to be punched in the face and just keep coming back and not losing your cool and not losing your composure, you know, retaining your fighting spirit, your optimism bias, which is definitely a necessity for starting a business. You know, you need to believe that tomorrow is going to be better than today.
I like that analogy. We're definitely going to use that. I just think, yeah, you know, the over glamification, if that's the right word, kind of, you know, propagated by, you know, whoever we want to kind of drop into the conversation about, you know, the grinds, you know, and working, you know, 20 hours a day or 18 hours a day or whatever, and people labeling themselves entrepreneurs, I think you're right. It literally is getting repeatedly punched in the face or getting your legs from taken underneath you. Mm. But I like that of ultimately thinking tomorrow's going to be a better day, or otherwise you wouldn't go and do the same thing again, would you? Definition of madness.
Isn't it just?
But do
hard things definitely is part of what I take from the military into business.
Yeah.
an ability to sit with fear, with discomfort, with uncertainty, that I suppose is part of the doing hard things. Mm-hmm. You know, that falls out of it. But it just makes you far more open to the unknowing and just getting out there and doing stuff, because fundamentally, you know, business, unlike the military, which has a huge resource infrastructure around it, a life support system, and it will just churn and churn and move inexorably forwards. You know, a startup business is just going to fall on its face if you take your attention off it for 5 minutes in the early days. So you need to have that, you know, even if it's misplaced, but nonetheless, just a sense of belief and optimism bias in life as an outlook in general. And I'd say the second thing that I took from the first life in the Marines is just the ability to think and plan and communicate that plan in a way that is understood by others, to then take the necessary actions to execute that plan and to do it in such a way that inspires trust and confidence in the people that are helping you do this. You know, it's leadership in other ways, which is something that is talked about so widely, but so seldomly practiced in any formal sense in a business capacity. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the military, you know, this is a huge, huge, huge thing. It's talked about, it's thought about, it's practiced, it's enabled, it's supported, it's something that is, the conditions are created to allow it to flourish. And of course it's in everybody's best interests that it does. And everybody has their own style and you develop that over time. But just that, the ability to take a very confusing picture with competing objectives and to think your way through it, to develop a plan.
Yeah.
You know, effectively align ends, ways and means. Mm. And again, that's a universal thing, whether that's military or business or anything else. So it's a real paradox, though, I think, in that the military, on one hand, can really equip you for life and business. And by life and business, you know, specifically mean setting up a company.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it can really make life difficult for you as well, because, and you know, personal experience of this exact thing is that you come from an organization whose way of being and way of operating is so doctrinally and procedurally ordained. You know, the Marines have been around since the mid-1600s. Hundreds upon hundreds of years of procedure, tactic, strategic best practice, ways of doing things, all being codified into doctrine, rules, procedures. Guaranteed that for any scenario, there's a plan for that.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a tactic for this, etc. The people around you, when the shit hits the fan, they all know the tactic and the procedure. Yeah. So bang, 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 things happen, problem solved. Whereas in business, in starting up a business, there's none of that at all. There's no, you know, there's no rule book.
No.
Every market, every product, every customer cohort, every set of early stage employees that you bring on all have their own unique characteristic. And so everything is different. And in the early chaotic days of trying to set up a business which only wants to do one thing, and that's fail, what you have orbing around you is just this incredible maelstrom of confusion, uncertainty, processes not working, this not talking to that, and on and on and on. I mean, nothing bloody works. Nothing works. It's friction. It's pushing water uphill.
Yeah.
Nothing works. It is nothing other, I think, than the most extreme act of will that's required to get a startup to a point where it's able to stand on its own two feet and take a breath. And every business is different in terms of how long it takes to get to that point.
Why a clothing brand? Where did that come from?
Yeah, so I've been, I suppose, actively properly climbing since the age of maybe 17, 18 as a student up in Edinburgh. That had developed later in life into mountaineering, alpinism, winter climbing, you know, really into these things in a big, big, big way. Steve had been and still is, you know, incredibly committed skier. And between the two of us, as the conversations developed around what this thing, this business might be, it became immediately clear to us that the thing that we were both ultra passionate about was, for him, skiing, for me, climbing, but collectively the mountains and the whole mountain scene, the culture, the spirit, the geography, the nature, everything that surrounds it. You're absolutely captivated by this thing. And the next question falling out from that was, well, with this being the case, what might be the business opportunity within this? And we'd both been, you know, as an active skier, him, active climber, me, you know, we had big wardrobes full of gear. And
it's half the fun, isn't it? It's buying gear.
Yeah, completely. And, you know, we thought that this gear was okay. It wasn't brilliant. And what there seemed to be was a real gap within the market for an ultra-technical, highly specialist brand to come along that produced ultra-focused mountain clothing. There's lots of other outdoor clothing brands at the time, as there still are. But they had all, and we'd seen them doing this, you know, as consumers over the years, this move where they would launch to market. Their first few years would be very pointy, very gnarly, very infused with that spirit of who they were and what they wanted to do. But as they grew bigger and as the pressure on the sales pipeline grew and grew, then that focus that they initially had in terms of product array just broadened.
Yeah.
And before you know it, you know, there they are, you know, with lumberjack shirts and trucker's caps and accessories for your dog and, you know, pub jackets and all of these things, which undoubtedly sell. They clearly do. But it's a very different proposition to what we had in mind. And again, as customers and consumers of this gear from these brands, you know, we both just found it a little bit distasteful that, you know, this jacket that spent quite a lot of money on was being made by a brand who were also making netball skirts.
Yeah.
And, you know,
But really conscious to narrow that focus and keep the focus narrowed, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that to us was the opportunity.
Okay. And who was the inspiration from there? Is it, you know, a Patagonia? Is it whomever?
Yeah. We were, you know, very aware of all of these companies, you know, especially the North American ones like Patagonia, as you mentioned, some of the Scandinavian ones. We were also just very aware of what we, as climbers and skiers, wanted that wasn't being served in the gear that was being made and was available on the market back then. And, you know, we thought that, you know, we had the know-how and the pedigree as just operators in the mountains to have a pretty good platform on which to design ultra-functional, ultra-robust, durable, dependable gear. And, of course, this is layered upon that previous but also parallel experience of both being in the military. You know, I remember in Afghanistan, you know, we'd be out on the ground for, you know, 45, 50 days on end without going back to, you know, what was Bagram Air Base to replenish, sort ourselves out. You know, we just stay out in the ground. And that was the best part of 2 months, literally wearing the same pair of trousers, the same pair of socks, the same pair of underwear.
Oh, Jesus.
But, you know, it's like alpine climbing. Enemy is the weight. You've got to go as light as you possibly can. And whilst you can't take risk on weapon systems, you've got to carry all of that with you. You can take a degree of risk on how much food you decide to carry with you and water. But in terms of clothing, you know, how uncomfortable you're willing to be or how smelly you're willing to be, you can ditch all of that just to be as light as possible. So, you know, we'd lived and breathed the whole clothes being used for a very specific function experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, that definitely bled into the design philosophy within the company.
And the name, where did that ultimately come from?
Yeah, so the name Jotnar, it's the slightly different spelling. Within Norse myth, the Jotnar were a race of frost giants, mountain giants. They were mankind's nemesis. And according to myth, the god Thor then came along with his hammer, which a representation of forms our logo. He destroyed the frost giants and opened up the mountains to mankind. And we thought,
love that.
That's a pretty cool story.
Yeah,
let's go with that.
Yeah, and I've read that you described the building the business originally as, you know, flying the plane whilst building it. which I love. And then, you know, those early years, you know, you describe really well. You know, nothing's working, you know, et cetera. And then, you know, ultimately, you're on a trajectory, if I can get my words right as well. You're on a trajectory. Is it hockey stick growth? Are there bumps in the road? Are there moments in your story or a moment in your story where it all could have ended tomorrow, and everyone I've spoke to over the years is like, no, we couldn't make payroll, we're on the verge of bankruptcy. For you, what was that, you know, that kind of screw it, just do it moment?
Yeah, there are all kinds of micro moments like that come your way, but you just become accustomed to them and they just become part of the noise. To the first part of your question, what was the first few years like, that hockey stick growth? It was. You know, we launched in 2013 with four products, and within the...
What were those four products?
It was a shell jacket called the Bergelmir, a down jacket called the Fjorm, a salopette called the Vanir, and a mid layer called the Alfar.
You passed the test, well done.
All of them, ultra cool. So, you know, we brought these things to market with not very much money at all. This was just the two of us.
Right, okay.
At this stage, you know, we
had... No funding.
Not at this stage.
So just bootstrapping.
So Steve and I, we had smashed our personal piggy banks. And between the two of us, we put 60 grand into the launch of the company up until the point of just before bulk production. Mm-hmm. We then needed to bring cash in to afford that. And we raised 150K with an angel investor. So basically 200K to launch a technical clothing brand with ambitions to produce the finest, the best technical clothing in the world and to sell this across the world.
And that doesn't come cheap to actually construct that.
It seemed like a lot of money at the time.
It was
absolute drop in the ocean. You know, if I was to go back and do it all again, I probably wouldn't consider doing it for anything less than 2 million, which just shows how expensive it all is, but it shows just how much we ducked and dived and bootstrapped our way through those first few years. The barriers to entry in this particular market are absolutely massive. You don't own your production facility. You rent effectively from existing production houses. And you don't tip up on their door and say, a small company just launched, can we have those blue jackets? But we'd like only maybe 4 or 5 of them. Well, you can have the blue jackets, but you're going to have to take 500 of them.
Yeah.
And until you start ordering 1,000 of them, you're not going to get the prices that in any way would reflect scale economy, which in any way would help your margin or anything like that. So, you know, you're effectively, unless you're able to just use your wits, you're in the position of being bankrupted before you've even launched the company. So, you know, huge amounts of street fighting in those early years to get this first range launched in 2013, which we did. And with the 6 months remaining of that financial year when we launched, you know, we sold almost £250,000 worth of 4 products.
Wow.
Which,
yeah.
I mean, that's no small amount of money.
Agreed.
You know, in today's context, it's quite small. But to us, this was a real validation of concept. You know, this whole notion that we'd had about the space within the market for an ultra-focused, ultra-high-quality and commensurately expensive brand there was demand for. And so that was our launch year, years 2, 3, 4, bang, 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 you know, this same growth pattern. And the street fighting didn't stop, of course. It became more normal, I suppose. We then found ourselves in the COVID years. And like everybody else, you know, it threw what was normal and what was predictable into the complete opposite. And supply dried up, you know, demand went through the roof, but there wasn't the supply in place to service it.
Yeah.
Then suddenly...
Because people were wanting to get out into nature and get out. Get it.
Absolutely. And then the supply problem worked its way through into effectively a position of oversupply within the industry. And there was now just more outdoor gear on the market than anybody knew what to do with. And by this stage, everybody was now back at work and not being paid to sit at home shopping on the internet. And, you know, factories were starting to reopen. Some weren't at all. So there's huge production logistical issues that we were having to navigate. And, of course, it's not just the factory relationships that you're navigating. The factories just assemble all of the components, and you assemble and source your components. You know, all of your trim, your embroidery thread, your elastic for the hems, you know, from a myriad of different suppliers all over the world. So you're like an orchestra conductor. You're trying to bring all of these things together at the right time to the factory at the right time so that they can do their thing at the right time and deliver all of this stuff, which has an unavoidable seasonal quality to it, so that it arrives in the country at the right time. You know, if every product that you produce feels like conducting a symphony, then, you know, as we got bigger, producing a range of 45, 50 pieces with multiple manufacturers, suppliers all over the world, add COVID into the top of this, you know, everything's upended. Mm. You know, it was pretty challenging. But, you know, I look back on those times and I see the street fighting mentality that had just been developed over those early years really coming through again. You know, we had to make some big decisions, really quick decisions, some what felt like very risky ones, but, you know, we just made them, and we made stuff happen, and by and large things worked out in our favor. So, you know, we got through that period more or less unscathed and popped out the other side, and things continued more or less in that vein.
And then, personally, what kind of toll does that take on you, that constant street fighting?
The honest answer, you know, very happy to talk about it as well, actually, because I think a lot of these kind of stories, these narratives, are all about this linear growth from startup to billionaire exit. You know, ultimate success stories. You know, and this is very much still a work in progress. But on a personal level, it does take a toll, and it's taken its toll on the pair of us in similar and in different ways, and at different phases of the company's development. But you know, the most profound example of this for me is actually quite a recent one, maybe just a year ago. And not being especially conscious of it at the time, but was just this increasing inability to concentrate, to focus. I could feel my creativity just diminishing, my motivation diminishing, my what had always been this real love for the company just starting to erode. And I was conscious of it. I just thought it was a phase.
Like harder to get out of bed in the morning, for example, to get excited about what you're doing that day?
I suppose that's one way of putting it. You know, I wasn't jumping out of bed with zeal.
Good word.
But I then started noticing all of these physical symptoms starting to present themselves. Initially, not particularly worried. You know, I could feel, you know, I've always been fit and healthy, and I haven't been particularly bothered by illnesses or injury or anything throughout my life. But I could feel what felt like, as a non-arthritis sufferer, what felt like arthritis starting to develop in my body. You know, my joints would stiffen up and become painful. I could then start feeling this incredible tightness almost on a minute-to-minute basis developing across my chest. I was losing the ability to sleep, compounding all of these things. You know, it looked like absolute shit. As I say, I'd lost the ability to focus, to think creatively, and start feeling these really unfamiliar feelings of uncertainty. Of I could feel my self-confidence eroding in a way that I wasn't familiar with at all. It was all really strange. And it all came to a head, really, when I walked into the office one Monday morning for the usual Monday morning team meeting, and pretty much turned around and walked back out again and said to Steve, I think I'm done. And it wasn't something that I chose or something that I even thought about or something that I even suspected was going to happen. I think what happened now, with the hindsight of almost 12 months, was that all of these symptoms, these physical symptoms that had been building up, I'd ignored the psychological ones, and I just and I just ground on through. The physical ones just went, fella, stop.
Yeah.
Enough. It was just the body saying, stop it. And as I say, I had no choice or control over this whatsoever. And
so you didn't go in with a plan to say, I'm done.
No, absolutely not. It just
came from somewhere.
It came from somewhere, but it very much needed to come. And it was absolutely the right thing to do. And without exaggeration, I think, had I not, then, you know, I would have found myself in a very, very bad place.
Yeah.
And that was the body just breaking through and making me do, I think, what needed to be done. So what that, of course, necessitated was a conversation with Steve and I. I'm just chucking him here, the mother of all hospital passes.
Yeah.
Which I'll be forever grateful to him for catching and for running with and effectively allowing me to just step back from the day to day for a period of what was two maybe 3 months.
Okay, I was going to ask how long
of last.
And that's like hands off, headspace
gone. So
look after yourself physically, yeah, and mentally. Yeah, all of that.
Yeah, I went home and I slept for about a week. Absolutely exhausted. Absolutely exhausted. You know, this is just 12 years of non-stop pressure, just building and building and building, and just doing that ridiculous early stage business thing of not taking time off and not
looking after
doing
yourself,
anything other than thinking about the business.
It just but it's all consuming though, isn't it?
Absolutely all. You'll know all of this.
Yeah 100%. And I always think it's, you know, it's those people that when you go on a family holiday and, you know, don't check the emails. Okay, I won't check the emails. But meanwhile, your brain is still computing in your head. You're almost seeing those emails and the things that you're working on or the challenge that you know you've left on your desk.
Yeah.
You know, it's difficult to not check an email because you're expecting, like, I don't know, like a new client to sign or whatever that might be. But you know, not being able to completely check out. Or you get to the end of that week or 2 weeks and you just feel that you're getting somewhere near total relaxation, and then you're back home and thrown back out into spat back out into the maelstrom of running the business.
It's absolutely relentless, isn't it? Absolutely unremitting. I think back to the number of so-called holidays that, you know, I ruined. You know, for me and Rach, my wife, you know, we'd find a block of a few days where, you know, I'd be able to get away from work and we'd go away somewhere. And exactly that thing would happen.
Right.
Just ruining the experience of trying to be away from the business. And of course, this all just compounds, and boom, you then become the human exploding balloon as I became back in the summer. So off I went.
Yeah.
And I closed everything down for the best part of 2.5 months.
Okay.
And didn't even open my laptop. You know, one of the first things I did after sleeping for a week was packed my van up, threw all my ropes, my climbing gear, my bikes into the back, and me and my friend Nick, we headed off to the Alps, and we spent a couple of weeks climbing and racing mountain bikes.
Amazing.
He then went home. I then spent another week on my own just cruising around, went down to Italy, did some more riding, more climbing down there. Just took a pause, really.
Yeah.
You know, and started to feel like a human again and started to, I suppose, begin the process of understanding what had happened and why. Mm. And, of course, with the normal pace of life as it normally is, you don't get the opportunity to do that. But I figured I now did, so it would probably be quite a useful and worthwhile thing for me to do, to just spend the next couple of months, you know, just reflecting on all of this and taking a view on what the future might look like as far as the business was concerned. But it was that whole thing was the culmination, I suppose, of, you know, what was and what still is, you know, a really quite difficult time in my life. You know, my father died. It's difficult saying that. Very unexpectedly. Just over 2 years ago. And, you know, he was... you know, he was everything to me, and as he was to my brother and sister. And if you knew him, you would single him out as being the least likely person to be affected by this thing called death. He was such an incredibly alive, charismatic person who held a room, not because of his size or his voice, but just because of who he was, this magnetism about him, you know, this charisma, this twinkle in his eyes, this humor that he had. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, came this end-of-life diagnosis for, you know, an otherwise incredibly fit, healthy man. And, you know, so...
Yeah, came in the last 12 months, 2 years ago.
Yeah, so
this
was in the run-up.
Another,
so this, got you. This, I think, was the foundation behind what was then the compounding and exacerbating effect of the professional life.
Got it.
You know, it was dealing with that. It was just processing grief of that nature, which I found very difficult in the way that, you know, I was a company founder with people around me and people looking to me, and it was incumbent upon me to not allow my emotions to get in the way of the day-to-day. And what I effectively found myself being in the position of was, you know, this great pantomime, I suppose, where I was pretending superficially that everything was fine for the benefit of others.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was absolutely dying inside. And, you know, that feeling over the course of the year that ran up to, you know, my little episode at work was... this feeling almost of being bent into shapes by the needs of individuals and by the needs of business that I just didn't want to be bent into, that I couldn't be bent into at that particular time of my life. And I think just the bandwidth and energy that was being consumed by having, through necessity, to live out this double life in a sense. Layer that, of course, on top of all of the usual growing a business stress and pressure, and you've got an absolute recipe for disaster there, as it so became.
That sounds like it's quite cathartic. What was I going to say? Where do you? We could probably go in like a. Go off piece and talk about a whole, you know, but I think it's really important to get this out there again because of, you know, as we said at the start of this part of the conversation, that kind of glamorized part of the conversation, and it probably doesn't get talked about at, you know, universities and networking events and all the rest of it, you know. So fast forward now, coming up to the quick fire questions to finish off, but maybe a final question would be, where are you now, like personally and business wise, like what's the vision? How are we feeling?
We're feeling good.
Good.
I think if the question is, are you where you want to be? The answer is, you know, it's a very definite no, but am I on the right path? And it's a very resounding yes. And I think that's, to me, exactly where I would want to be, because there's something in the pursuit of things that is, I believe, far more valuable than the actual having of things. Mm. And, you know, I'm in a position now where there's a long road still ahead professionally, and the street fighting ain't going to end anytime soon. Mm-hmm. But I'm on the right path, and I feel that personally as well.
Nice. Okay.
And being on the right path is a wonderful feeling to have, because it's taking you where you want to go.
Yeah.
And the reality is, I think, is that if one was to say, I am exactly where I want to be right now, well, you might be right now, but you'll probably have a different answer to that next week.
Agreed.
Yeah. The horizons always change. Yeah. They always shift. And I've always had a sense that, personally, again, the more up in the air things are, the more unsettled, the more challenging a picture is, the more I'm at my best, mm-hmm. 100%. The more comfortable I become, the more certain I am of what's going to happen tomorrow, the more the side of me that I don't particularly like becomes more dominant. Mm. So to be in a position of pursuit, but being on the right path in that pursuit is a good place to be.
Like it. Okay, so quick fire questions, quick fire answers to finish off. What was the one thing you needed to do to screw it, just do it and get from where you were, maybe climbing in Chamonix, to where you are now with Jotna, given what we've just talked about has happened in the last 12 months? Yeah.
Lots of small ones, but I suppose the big one is leaving the Marines.
Yeah.
A career and an organization that meant so much to me, a guaranteed future up until the age of 55 with a nice, comfortable pension.
Yep.
Deciding without knowledge of actually what I wanted to do, I effectively artificially created the conditions of chaos by putting my notice in and resigning.
I love that. I love that.
Such that I could bring out that side of me that I thought would take me to where I needed to go.
That's a really good answer. We covered, are you currently where you want to be? Next one would be, what piece of advice would you give anybody else who's listening or watching to help them get from where they are to where they want to be?
Yeah.
It's difficult because there's a million things you could say, but what would one thing?
Said it a few times. If you're not already, do hard things. It doesn't have to be epic. You don't have to traverse Antarctica. But you can get out of bed every morning at 6 o'clock and put your running shoes on and go running in the darkness. Anyone can do that, and it's hard. But if you do that enough, it becomes a habit. And what you start doing is acclimatizing yourself to discomfort. You become more able to sit with the emotions, fear, for example, that come along with hard things. Mm. And far less likely, I think, to become a passenger to your emotions, which is such a great derailer of ambition and dreams, being derailed by your ambitions. So acclimatize yourself to the path ahead. Go running in the mornings, jump in a cold bath, go swimming in the sea like you.
Love
whatever
that.
It is, just do hard things and make a habit of them.
Brilliant. Well, Tommy Kelly, thank you so much indeed for swinging by. It's been an absolute pleasure. We could go on for hours. I think there's all areas that I could go back into and explore that we've covered and kind of divided it, you know, almost like 50-50 of like the first journey, the first 10 years and then the last 10-15 years. So it's maybe there's an episode two in here.
It feels like there is.
I know.
No, it'd be a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for watching this episode of Screw It, Just Do It. Let me know what you thought of it in the comments below this video. Has this episode helped move you closer to where you want to be? All that I ask is that if you enjoyed this episode and that it's moved you closer to getting to where you want to be, that you share this episode so that it helps one other person do just the same. Just ask yourself what small action will move you forward to get you from where you are, then screw it and just do it. Until next time.